Hi. Welcome to the session on women on boards and in senior management. We're very lucky today to have this topic and Jenny to arrange it. So many of you will know Jenny Lyon, who's the head of Acumen, which has recently changed its name, formerly QED, which many of you would have known over the years. Jenny herself has experience in small business management, consulting to financial services organisations about their recruitment needs, and providing career advice and management services to individuals. She's the Managing Director of Acumen Resources, a global actuarial recruitment consulting firm. And Jenny and I together have been working to establishing a women's network in the Institute. So hopefully many of you have been invited to women's networking lunches, which have been very successful. Last year there was the Young Actuaries Program session on developing your career and different issues that women face. And there are other items on the agenda going forward. Jenny's been involved in a number of different institute committees, and also she'd be familiar to many of you as through her role as editor of Actuary Australia, which she held for a number of years. So I'm going to hand over to Jenny and looking forward to an interesting discussion.
Thanks, Bronwyn, and thank you all for coming along. Bronwyn's already said what I was going to say in my 2 minutes, but that's okay. So I'm just going to introduce the topic, really. This has been a very easy session to arrange because I've got a couple of great speakers here. So,
come on,
Bronwyn. Okay. So I was just going to give you a little bit of background and I guess my personal perspective as to why I felt it was possibly worthy to have a session on this topic. I'm then going to introduce Ruth Med, who is the chair of Women on Boards, and get some input from Jenny Sparks, who's a senior actuary who many of you will know is an Australian actuary but has been working in Japan for a number of years, and I'll introduce them when I get to it. So as Bronwyn said, I was editor of Actuary Australia for a few years, and in one of my editorials I wrote a small amount about, was the time right for us to consider having a women's network, thinking about having a stronger link between the women within the actuarial profession? And what did I do wrong? Sorry.
Okay.
I don't know how well you'll be able to read this, but as a response to my editorial, somebody sent me these advertisements which they'd had seen in the newspaper when they started doing actuarial studies, saying that scholarships will be awarded to selected male matriculants and legal in general. Perhaps I should have taken the names off the companies, but anyway, so very much, very clearly seen as a male profession. And I remember one of the senior actuaries at AMP saying to me that Catherine Prime, who was our first female president, had applied to AMP as an actuarial student, he said to me. But AMP just was not ready to have female actuaries. So anyway, so that just sort of set the scene a little bit. And I think we've come a long way since then. We've had at the university courses, you know, 50% females taking the courses for some time now. Bronwyn responded to my editorial and said, yes, Jenny, we need to do something about this. So as she said, we organized some lunches. We organized tables at the last conference, and we had a Young Actuaries session where I invited some senior female actuaries to come along and talk. And we had a great attendance, and there were lots of questions, probably one of the best sessions I've ever been to. And they just spoke very honestly about what had been important to them in their career and how they had moved themselves forward. So probably the purpose of this session was just to raise some discussion. I'm not coming in here trying to promote a particular view. I'm interested to hear what people have to say, and I think that Ruth will lead us down the track that if a board career or a senior management career is something that you want, it's something to be thinking about early on in your career. So I have plenty of questions for the end if people don't have thoughts that they want to talk about. And so I'm actually just going to pass it on to Ruth now, and I'll make some more comments at the end. So Ruth Med is the chair of Women on Boards. I attended a session that Women on Boards ran fairly recently and was impressed in particular about the way in which they talked about how you present yourself. So as many people know, I've done recruitment for a long time now, and so I have perhaps said far too many times, well, I used to be an actuary, or I've got an actuarial background, but, you know, and they pulled me up on this straight away, and similarly pulled up some lawyers who said, well, I used to be a lawyer, because as Melinda said last night in her opening speech, it's about your thinking process. It's very much about the way you present yourself. And in fact, talking to a lot of people at the dinner last night, one of the things that they said to me was, it's all about confidence. It's about women recognizing that they have the skills, and whether they want to go in that direction is their choice. So I don't know if that's where Women on Boards came from, but anyway, Ruth has had a career as a non-executive director since 2000. She's chair of the Australian Ethical Superannuation Limited, Women on Boards, and a director of National Foundation for Australian Women, and has previously been a director of the Infants Home in Ashfield and the New South Wales Casino Control Authority. So her non-executive director experience have enabled her to contribute to her finance and business management expertise, as well as her in-depth understanding of the public policy, regulatory and business interface. Previously, she had executive roles, including executive director of the Australian Association of National Advertisers and senior positions with Telstra, the Australian Broadcasting Tribunal and the federal government. And she's going to talk to us about Women on Boards. Thank you.
Okay. Hi, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. My challenge for today, I think, is to persuade you that you might all make fine company directors at some stage. So that's the premise. Before doing that, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about Women on Board. Why waste the opportunity to give up a promo when it's on offer here? So here we go. Women on Boards was a good idea 10 years ago. These days we're a slightly more professional organisation, in as much as there's more of us, and we're not a bunch of volunteers. But we're true to our origins, which is that we are a social enterprise for trying to get more women into senior leadership roles in Australian society. Because back then we recognised that women are a bit underdone. The economy is missing out if it doesn't utilise its people power fully. And there was also a social justice case for giving women a fairer go. So over the time, we've established a methodology for what we call facilitating women onto boards. And so we, in fact, have a range of things that we offer people, offer mainly women. But we also understand you've got to work on the supply as well as the demand as well as the supply side of things. So we're out there in the media, spruiking the cause, basically. And that's not been too difficult just of late. It's been a very popular topic. And a range of things have happened that I'll mention shortly that should make it easier for women to get recognised as being suitable for a range of these positions that perhaps wasn't the case in the past. When I was a very junior public servant, we'd have a review of federal legislation, which always sort of said he, and people, not myself at that stage, would say, well, it's he or she, and why does it matter? And it matters because people don't notice there aren't any women if there aren't any. It's not a natural thing to say, oh, here we are, chaps, having a monthly meeting, and where are the girls if there aren't any? And that's just human nature sort of thing. So there's a bit of an issue there. Okay, one of our cornerstones of Women on Boards is transparency in recruitment of directors. Our view is if people don't know the vacancies are there, they won't apply for them, which is pretty obvious, really. Think about how senior executives get recruited, possibly by word of mouth, possibly by search, rarely by public advertisement. And people say that's the best way to do it. Directorships are a bit different. There's a huge number of people willing to put their hand up to be directors. So supply is far in excess of demand. The Women on Boards Network, which is now about 10,500 people, they're all interested. So in that environment, advertising makes a really good sense, because place an ad on our website, which we offer that service as a free service. As I should say, as do these days the Institute of Company Directors, they thought we were doing some good things, so they sort of copied us, I might suggest. And you've got a captured cohort who are interested. So advertising works wonders. And also, once you advertise, you get all sorts of people out of the woodwork that you would never have known about otherwise. So cornerstone, transparency. When you offer transparency, it actually means you've got to put more rigour behind who you go looking for. And that's one of the other issues with, in particular, directorship recruitment. It's a relatively new idea to have selection criteria and to look at the skills of the existing board members and to ask the question, where are the gaps? Now, good companies have done that for some time, but a lot of them never have. And particularly the very large number of not-for-profits and smaller private and listed companies, I might suggest, are not very rigorous about how they approach looking for new people. So all that builds up to exclude women from the pile. That is the fact. So to do something about that, as I said, Women on Boards has a methodology for not only tackling the transparency issue, the public face of increasing numbers of women, that's the advocacy role, and then we do some things that, in fact, Jenny alluded to before, that assist women to better place themselves as potential candidates. So that's Women on Board. Now, I said earlier things have changed just of late, and a couple of things have happened, and in fact I was going to talk about three things today. The ASX Corporate Governance Council guidelines, which I'm sure you're all quite familiar with. Why is directorship good for your career? And then a bit about what does a 21st century director look like compared with perhaps what a previous director looks like. Now, since I sent these slides in, the world has once again changed a little bit. But probably the most significant strategic development is the adoption of the revised Principle 3 for the ASX Corporate Governance Guidelines, which, for those of you who are not familiar with it, requires diversity reporting in annual reports. Basically means you've got to go and count your women, report at what levels they're at in your organisation, and to think about having a diversity plan for your board. It's optional. You don't have to. You can have an if not, why not, as most of you will realise. But it'll be a brave chairman who decides that we'll take the if not, why not path, might I suggest. The reason for that is that there's been lots of action already before those guidelines have actually come into force, which was the 1st of January this year. And large companies are announcing in the media, you know, we have targets for women. You'll have seen the big banks do that. You'll see some annual reports for this cycle have been talking about diversity and the numbers of women. So competitive forces are on the job. Some people are going out there hiring women, talented female executives to join the ranks of their corporation to bolster the case. It's interesting that financial services is a sector close to our hearts here in Sydney. I'm on a FINSIA working party about looking at women in banking and finance. And the other day I got the figures in the banking and finance sector, as defined by the ABS, 51% of the employees are female out of the 400 and something or other thousand employees. So they've got a bit of an issue, and they're starting to recognise it. So in addition to the other two sectors in the economy, which are basically healthcare and then the education-type sector, which have a preponderance of female employees, we now have another sector, financial services, which in many ways is easier to crack vis-à-vis more women in senior roles, in my view, for a whole range of reasons. Anyway, so that's principle three. On International Women's Day, Minister Ellis announced the legislative program for changes to the EOWA Act, whose name I can never quite get right, Equal Employment Opportunity in the Workplace Agency Act. Fortunately, they're going to change its name, which is a bit of a bonus, I reckon. But they reviewed that act some time ago and people put in submissions. I, as part of my hat with the National Foundation for Australian Women, with help from a whole lot of diversity specialists from the top end of town, put in a strong submission, which in fact mirrored the ASX corporate governance guideline arrangements that have come to pass. So all employers with more than 100 people now have to report on the numbers of women in their organisation. I think that's actually very important. It looks benign, perhaps, although some people think quotas are coming, which I might just say a couple of words about later. But it's this case of let's analyse the problem and then think about, do we have some strategies that we wish to put in place to solve this problem if we think we have one? Classic management cycle stuff. I'm hopeful that that will do a fair bit to change the cultural norms around organisations in Australia. If it doesn't, then perhaps more drastic action might be needed. So that's the other plank of the change to the strategic / legislative framework. Very important in my view. Now, let's talk about directors. You all know what directors do, I'm sure, but my version of what directors do is, first of all, and this is a pinch from Carolyn Hewson, a comment that she made some time ago. I thought it was very apposite. Directors bring a moral compass to issues. If all else fails, directors have to sit there and say, are we doing the right thing? Sometimes management forgets to ask that question. Sometimes when they do ask it, they get the wrong answer. And sometimes when directors ask that question, they don't get the right answer. So your challenge as a potential director is to join the team that gets the right answer more often than not, because that's your judgment and your reputation in the marketplace. Clearly, as a director, you come with a different set of antecedents than other people in a company. So you've got the capacity to add intellectual rigour to discussions from your perspective as a director, not as an employee. And taken together with your colleagues, you should be able to have vigorous, enlightening discussions. And the evidence is that, of course, that a diverse group of people will have a wider range of issues that they raise on a particular topic. It's harder for the chairman to corral the horses, so to speak, but a really good chairman will get to a really good result that has widely canvassed the issues that have been put forward by management in their board paper and have also been contributed by the experiences of the directors. But it's not all fun and big picture stuff. You've then actually got to do a bit of detailed review on certain types of items that come to boards. You're not there, as you all know, to replace management, but it's really interesting how history gets a bit forgotten in some organisations. Matters that had perhaps been canvassed and resolved in past years get brought up again because they were potentially a good idea, perhaps, but just didn't quite make it. And so directors there have a view of history to some extent. And that, in my view, is one of the reasons why directors sit on company boards for a reasonable length of time. There's lots of arguments about how long's too long, but you certainly need a body of corporate history for an organisation, as you all know, and the question is where do you get that from, and one of the sources is directors. So that's my version of what directors do, the big picture stuff and the detailed stuff. And that's my view of what's a good director. Informed, network, professional, able to add value, and wise and of sound judgment. Executives of companies like to think that the board of directors adds something to the organisation. And so as a director, you need that persona of sufficient gravitas to in fact fit that bill. It's very difficult for chairman to put people onto their board who the management don't have some regard for. So you need to sort of remember that when you're pitching for board roles. Now, why is getting on a board important in your career? Now, you might think it's not. You can sally forth and be whatever you are, ad infinitum, so to speak, and most of you, I'm told, are actuaries, so there you go. But as an executive in an entity, you spend some of your time interacting with your board, with the board members. If it's by contributing to board papers, if it's by making submissions and talking to board papers, if it's whatever else you do as you interact with the board. You are a better person as an executive if you actually have a view about how board members view executives and vice versa. So I think that's actually one good reason for thinking about joining a board, to basically sit on the other side of the table and also to appreciate the full range of views that come to a board rather than the more limited range of views that you will inevitably be faced with as an executive in your organisation. You get to see it all. You get to worry about all those things that you don't have to worry about as an executive, you know. Basically broadens your horizons. Women on Boards says to women, it's never too soon to become a director of something. There are lots of boards that look for young people, for example. There are lots of boards that appreciate the skills of a qualified professional. There are also lots of boards who are looking for senior executives who are wanting to move on to the next stage of their career. So there's a spot for everybody. And the benefit to you is, as I've previously mentioned, you get to see the world from the other side of the table. If you happen to take on a board role while you're still an executive, then you have the opportunity to fly the flag for your organisation. So I have no problems in suggesting to people that they should get the support of their employer to sit on a board, and preferably in, you know, work time, although that doesn't mean much because you all work all the time anyway. And then the issue there is, what's the policy of the company that you work for, and what are the conflicts that may or may not arise. So there's a lot of rules around that, but that's a second order issue from the general principle that why not join a board and broaden your experience, broaden your horizons, add value to you, to your performance as an executive, and get a taste of what might be on offer down the track for you. Now, a little exercise here. I thought we'd do something practical. This is one of the things we do in one of our workshops to try and give people an idea of what they should be targeting for their sort of next board role. So what you do is you just add up the numbers, essentially. Career stage, give yourself a 1, 2 or a 3, depending on where you're at. Board experience, if you don't have any, give yourself a 1. If you've got some, a 2, and if you've got lots of board experience, give yourself a 3. Now, don't discount committees, industry associations, that sort of stuff. And don't discount the fact that perhaps you interact with board members a lot. That's equivalent to low-level board experience. And then if you've been on any boards, just give yourself a number, 1, 2 or 3. If you haven't, give yourself a 1, okay? So you've got a score. We're all pretty good at that. I'm probably 3, 2, 2.5 in my case. About 7.5, I'd say. Ah, now, what's happened here? I think we're missing the answer. Okay, who's got a score 3 to 5? Hands up. A lot of people. 6 to 7. Okay, any 8s to 9s? Okay, the answer is, the suggestion, if you've got a 3 to 5, is that you start off things like industry-type bodies, or advisory committees or working committees of your industry association, you might start off with a worthy not-for-profit, provided it has staff members, a modest amount of money, and some decent people on the board. And you might start off putting your hand up for government committees, sort of thing. That's 3 to 5. That's a good place to start, because what essentially you're doing is you're using your professional expertise, your current professional expertise, to add value to an organisation. If you're 6 to 7, then you should aim a little higher. You might be looking for government business enterprises that actually run things, actually run a business. You might be looking for a smaller listed company. You might be looking for a private company, if you can find them. They're a bit hard to find. And you might, if you're bold, want to look for a startup enterprise. Now, I did mention much earlier, that you have to think about what your employer will permit you to do if you're in that circumstance, and some of those things may not be available to you. But that's the general principle. If you're at 8 to 9, you're looking at larger ASX-listed companies, large government business enterprises. The world is your oyster, so to speak. Okay? So that was the answer. I'm sorry that the slide missed out of the pack here. Okay, what do ASX board directors look like? Up until last year, when there was a big push from the top end of town to get a few more women onto ASX 200 boards, the classic recruitment ground for them for an ASX 200 listed company board was somebody who's on an ASX listed company board. sorry. people who've been CEOs of listed companies are in hot demand, because there is a presumption by the boards of more conservative ASX-listed company boards that CEOs know how it all works, and they've got the experience and they've run things. Then there was a small component of investment bankers, consultant, corporate lawyers, and there was less than 10% women. Okay. What should a board look like, in my view? You can be a director on a whole range of things, and in my view, that's useful directorship experience. So one of the challenges for ASX 200 companies looking for women directors is to look a bit beyond those that are already directors. And you will see that happening. You know, there's the big cry that last year a whole 59 women got appointed to ASX 200 company boards. That's almost true. A couple of them dropped off the peg after they'd been counted. But of that 59 or so, about half of them were new to the ASX 200. That's really quite a great achievement. Somebody had gone looking and found them. They were there the previous year when just about no women were appointed to ASX 200 company boards, but you go looking and you find them. And those women, you will notice, are exceptionally well qualified. They were appointed because of the skills, and they happen to be women. And so what happened between 2009 and 2010? What happened actually was the threat that quotas were coming. That's the reality. What they got was ASX Corporate Governance Council Principle 3. And I'll just, as my final remarks, just mention a bit about quotas. CEOs of ASX-listed companies were very popular, but you have to think a bit more broadly. There are lots of people in large corporates that are perfectly qualified to be on the board of a listed company. It's just that they traditionally weren't. There are very few women CEOs, but there are a few more women line managers. If you're in a company and you think you'd like to sit on an ASX-listed company and the policy permits your CEO to do so, why wouldn't you put your hand up and say, I would like to as well? Because inevitably the way to find directors for ASX-listed company boards is to look at people who are known to that part of the world. And as I said, it's great for your development. There's always been a claim that there's no IT people, HR people, marketing people, etc. on ASX-listed company boards. The argument there is that, well, we need people who've run things, who've had operational experience. That's partly true, so anybody who's the GM of HR somewhere, go and get yourself a line role, ladies. Quick, smart. And if you get offered one, don't think you can't do it, because I'm sure you can, and they wouldn't have offered it to you if they thought otherwise. Okay. Women on Boards position is that we think that by 2012 there should be 25% females on ASX 200 boards, and by 2015, 40%. That's akin to the three women on the board mantra, where all the research says that until you've got three females on a board, they really don't have as much impact. You don't get the full value of their impact from the fact that they have, you know, a bunch of views. They cease to be identified as, you know, the token woman sort of thing. Now, what else have I got here? There's a couple more slides here. Do people get the slides?
They will.
Yeah, I'm not proposing to talk to these couple of slides. That's just an indication of how you put selection criteria together. Now, merit, my final remark. The number of people say, oh, it would be a tragedy if we had quotas because we wouldn't be selecting on merit. Or alternatively, a female's asked, would you like to join this board as our initial female director? And they say, oh, look, I don't want to be selected because I'm female. I want to be selected on merit. Merit is a complete construct. It's whatever you choose it to mean. In 1864, the Northcote Trevelyan Report looked into the matter of merit in the British Civil Service, and they recommended that merit should replace patronage as the way of selecting people for the administrative class. And Queen Victoria thought that would be dreadful. She might get people who weren't proper gentlemen. I mean, and their definition of merit was a degree in classics from Oxford or Cambridge. I mean, times move on. These days, in 2009, the definition of merit for Australian ASX 200 listed companies was male, ex-CEOs, etc., as I demonstrated in that slide earlier. Today's definition, one hopes, is that it's a little broader than that. You don't actually have had to be the CEO of an ASX listed company, perhaps. Perhaps you could be the CEO of a large charity, and there are more females there than there are in ASX 200 companies, for example. So when you get asked, you know, come and join this board, we're looking for a woman, don't presume that you're being asked just because you're a woman. You might conclude that they've asked you because you've got lots of skills and you happen to be a woman. So that gets to the point about the threat of quotas. No one in Australia much, one or two people have suggested that quotas for board directorships is the way to go. Women on Boards has not said that, I might say. Not yet, anyway. But that threat has resulted in action, and it's resulted in those 59 women being appointed last year, and we're up to number 16, I think, this year. The fact is that those numbers are not going to get us to 25% in the next couple of years, unfortunately. But people are making an effort. But remember, below ASX 200, it's a wasteland. There's about 5% of women on ASX 200 to 300 boards. There's no indication that any of them are making much of an effort to find any women. So there is sort of work to be done. But remember, if you are asked to join the board of the XYZ company because you come from Perth and we need somebody from Perth, you wouldn't be offended, would you? If you're asked to join the board of the XYZ Company Limited because you're female and we need a female, the answer is the same. You just have to make proper inquiries that, you know, that's the board for you, they appreciate your skills, etc., etc., due diligence. But don't say, I don't want to be the token female, because it really doesn't quite work that way. And remember that federal government boards, for example, have had an undisclosed quota for 30 years. They require that there be women on their boards. They also require that there be a geographic spread on their boards. So that's my final note, the saga of merit, aka women on boards.
Thank you, Ruth. That was great. And perhaps I look forward to some questions later on. Okay, so now I'd just like to introduce Jenny Sparks. Jenny is here from Tokyo, unaffected by the earthquake, I'm pleased to say. So Jenny worked with AMP in Australia for 15 years and moved to Japan in 1997. And over the last 13 years there, she's had a wide variety of senior management roles, which have included country manager, chief underwriter, chief risk officer, chief financial officer, regional CFO and director in charge of finance with GE, Manulife and AIG. Most recently, she was the director of AIG Edison Life and led the accounting, actuarial and investment teams through the GFC and the subsequent sale of Edison Life to Prudential. She's currently enjoying a brief break from paid employment, although she still has some board activities. She's treasurer of Hope International Development Agency Japan, which is an NPO focusing primarily on the neglected poor in Southeast Asia and also currently helping with the relief efforts for those impacted by the tsunami in Japan. Jenny's just going to talk to us a little bit about her experiences. And if I know Jenny, she won't have a very long break from employment. Thank you.
Okay, let me state right up front, I love being the token female, and I have been all my career. Also, Ruth has been talking quite a lot about non-executive directors. My role primarily have been as executive director. The mandate from Jenny today for me was not to focus so much on being female, but how do you go from being an actuary and very much a technical person to actually being on a board. So that's what I'd like to just explore a little bit today. What are the changes in skills that I've gone through in moving from head of a technical area to moving onto boards? And I'm sure that many of you are already in management roles, so it's moving out of your technical space. So there are five things that I'd like to talk about today. The first one is be an active listener. Now, that was one of the biggest changes for me, was to listen first and talk second rather than getting my view out there right in front of everybody else. Now, moving to Japan is quite a big step, and I don't suggest you all do it, but that had a very beneficial effect, because when I was in meetings, everybody was there talking, and I'm thinking, right, translate in my head, here's my view, English to Japanese, now speak, by which time most people had moved on. Also, when listening to people, I had to listen very carefully to pick up the language, and on top of all of that, looking for nuances and body language. So that did mean that I got very used to listening, and it has been very beneficial, because now I sit back, and rather than getting my view out there and then letting other people speak and going, well, are they in line with my thinking or are they not, I now sit back, listen to their views, assess them, and then respond. So being an active listener is important. Secondly, balancing the quantitative and the qualitative. So as actuaries and mass commerce graduates, we go for the numbers first. So I need to make a decision, right, where's my business case? Look at the business case, numbers don't add up, right, that concept is toast and I don't think about it anymore. Well, that's really not the end of the story, because there are two important aspects. One is that business cases are based on assumptions. Assumptions are not facts. Secondly, there are a lot of people involved in businesses. There are your customers, there's staff, and there's also your distributors. And the feelings and perceptions of those people very much drive the ultimate result. So it's not all about the numbers. Now, I'm not suggesting that when you see a business case that makes it very, very clear that there's going to be a negative financial impact, that you actually go forward with that business case. What I'm suggesting is that when the business case is borderline, or when there is significant uncertainty about the assumptions that are going into that business case, that you think far more carefully about the qualitative side of the equation. That's tough. And particularly in this last year, I've had a lot of business cases that didn't stack up, and it's been 4-1 in the board meetings. And I've really had to step back and go, okay, what are they pushing and why are they pushing this? Number three, embrace teamwork. And Seamus today said the best actuaries are those who work as part of a team. And I couldn't agree more. As actuaries, we're very used to being top of the class. And we're very used to being the person with the highest IQ in the room of our non-actuarial peers. But due to the fact that the actuaries spend most of their career in specialist and technical areas, you don't necessarily have a grasp of the other aspects of the business. Believe it or not, we don't know it all. And particularly areas that, like Ruth mentioned, the IT, the operations, sales, very, very important sales, and very few actuaries have experience in sales, customer service, all of those areas. Other people in the business and other people on your board will have a better grounding than you do. So at a board level, it's necessary to have a much broader perspective and to make sure that the decisions are grounded in a basis of all the aspects of the business, not just the finance. So I've certainly found that not only is it very important, but it's also far more rewarding to actually pursue the team agenda than an individual agenda. So enjoy the team you're working with, make the most of the people you're working with, and develop your interpersonal skills so that you can actually work within that team, add value to the team, but also gain value from your other team members. Now, diversity is all well and good, but if you sit there as one of the minority in all sorts of senses on a board and don't speak up, you're not adding value. So my fourth point is, don't be afraid to actually express a divergent view. Now, many of you might say, hey, wait, doesn't your fourth point contradict your third point? And no, it doesn't. It's all about balance. So you need to go for consensus, and in Japan particularly, the board has to be unanimous. So you're working towards achieving consensus amongst the board, but if you truly believe that the decision being made is wrong, or you believe that a very important point is being overlooked, you have a responsibility to stand up and express that, even if yours is the sole dissenting voice. The board that I've most recently have been on, a board of five people, I was the only woman, the only foreigner, and the only finance person. So my perspective was often different to my fellow board members. Reading board papers was quite a challenge because I would read through these papers and I'd go, oh my gosh, here it goes again. I know I'm going to be in a different position to the other people. And I'd look to see, can I actually agree with where they're coming from? Or do I need to say something? If I needed to speak up, the challenge for me was actually expressing my view comprehensively in a foreign language in the pressure situation that's aboard. So I would call up the CEO and I'd go, I've got an issue here, We need to talk. So we would sit down one-on-one and I would explain to him where I was coming from. And then in board meetings, he would make sure that my opinion was heard, even if he, in fact, did not support my view. So it's very important to, if you can't get it out there yourself, find a champion that you can work with to get your view heard. And my final point is be happy to be a role model. As a director, everybody will be watching you, whether you like it or not. They will be judging your actions, they will be judging what you say. I find I'm often asked for career and lifestyle advice from not only women, but actuaries, actuarial students, and sometimes people who, or men who are not even in the finance world. Now, this is often uncomfortable because lifestyle choices are individual, and it's not clear how much what I've done is going to help them. And also, in a very busy day, it's often hard to say, hey, I'm going to take time out to talk to this person about their lifestyle choices. But you are going to be a role model whether you like it or not. So take it as a positive experience. And that means not only positively responding to those who come and ask you for that, but also actively seeking out people who have got potential and who may benefit from your mentoring and your encouragement. One of the best things about being on a board and being visible has been the access it's given me to a wide range of people that I wouldn't otherwise come across. So finally, throughout my career, I've always been told, play to your strengths. However, I think for myself and the advice I give the people I come in contact with is improve upon your weaknesses. That is how you're going to develop. And we hear all the time that the weakness of actuaries, very broad generalisation, is communication and teamwork. And as I've mentioned through these points, I believe they're fundamental to being on a board.
Okay. Thank you to both Jenny and Ruth, and Jenny Lyon as well. I found that really interesting. I'm conscious that the bell's just ringing outside, so we don't have a lot of time for questions. But the idea of the session was that we would have an opportunity for questions, and there is a microphone. So if you have questions, could you please come up to the microphone because it is being recorded. So feel free.
Well, I'm Maria Nazaré Barroso from Portugal. I'm the president of the Portuguese Institute of Actuaries. I've been around the world in many actuarial conventions, seminars, congress, and it's the first time I see this topic in a conference like this. So I would like first to congratulate the organization because of this topic being discussed in this session. I am from Portugal. This is a small country in Europe, only 10 million inhabitants. And more than 70% of actuaries are women.
Wow.
Yes, different situation. But only a few are on boards. That's the fact. So I was going to ask some of you, and Ruth already spoke about merit and how we should look at merit, but what is your opinion about quotas? Should we have quotas for women on boards? Forget about merit. And what's your opinion? Thanks.
Do you want to?
Okay. Just speaking to the microphone.
Yes.
Okay, the question about quotas on boards. I was sitting on an aeroplane the other day, and Alan Kohler's very entertaining program on Channel Number 3 was interviewing Anne Sherry, who you will know, is the CEO of Carnival Enterprises. And at the end of the interview, the last question was, do you support quotas for women on boards? And Anne said, it's been 20 years now since we've been talking about getting more women onto boards. We've done a whole lot of things. We've had diversity plans inside organisations, at least the ones she's worked in, and we're not making much progress. So there does appear to be a blockage there that to date we have not been able to get past. So perhaps it's time for quotas. So I think that point of view is quite interesting. Women on boards, this position is, we're willing to give it a go with the incentives that are in place at present, but if they don't deliver, we have a view similar to Anne Sherry.
Up until now, I've not supported the idea of quotas. I can certainly appreciate what Ruth has said, but I've struggled against people looking at me and going, well, you're there because you're a woman. And I believe that all the roles I've held because I was good at that role, and it's been somewhat offensive to be assumed that I was there as a woman. However, it has been 20 years, and maybe it is the only way to go.
Elaine Collins from Deloitte. Thank you. That was a really, really interesting presentation. But I really noted the comment that the ASX 200 take for their board members ex-CEOs of the ASX 200. And I just wondered how are you managing to change views around, from both of your points of view, how are we getting people to change their views around those are the best board members and that a diverse board is a sensible thing?
Okay.
Thank you,
Elaine. There's been a lot of coverage of the topic of more women on boards in the media, and quite a bit of that's been modestly educative. Also, there are some very enlightened chairmen around who understand that if you want to go and look for somebody a little bit different other than where you might have looked previously, you have to do something differently. And the combination of those things, I think, has resulted in boards looking for women who are not the traditional types of directors. And if you look through the biographies of some of the newly appointed ASX 200 directors, you'll see where they came from. I think at our conference this month we've got Kim Anderson, who's on the board of Car Sales. She's the CEO of a business that no one's really ever heard of, that certainly isn't ASX listed as far as I can tell. They found her there. I know, for example, that whatif.com, the CEO there was told to go and find a new director, and his driving instructions were, we need somebody who's going to lower the average age of the board members because they're all over 60. We need somebody who is female, and we need somebody who's got strong financial skills. And they found a perfectly, absolutely excellent person, Kayleen Gaffrey, I think her name is, who I met not so long ago, who fits the bill in spades and is, you know, merit plus. So it's a case of go and look in other places, really, and make the effort to do so and put the pressure on the people who are helping you to do that to come up with people that we hadn't thought of already.
I can't really add to that one because my experience is Japan, and I can assure you they're a long way behind Australia.
Can I just add, really, that whilst we've sort of talked about women on boards here, I feel that changing the whole recruitment process for boards is probably something that's important, and that partly solves the whole merit issue, because clearly if you've been through a fairly structured sort of recruitment process, you have taken merit into account. I also think we need to think about diversity more broadly than just female and male. For example, I don't know any numbers about this, I'm making it up really, but I think that we probably don't have the same Asian component on a number of the boards, and I think, you know, people coming from different types of businesses will bring a very different perspective, and that as actors we need to be able to recognise that and work with people from different areas. So hopefully that will also help if the process moves us towards a better recruitment process.
As the chair, I'm probably not meant to editorialise, but I'm going to anyway, which the people who know me probably aren't surprised by. I also think there's a lot of stuff coming out in the media at the moment, as you've said, which actually says that diversity on boards is a good, is a positive thing. Companies that have at least three women on the board globally actually do better financially. I think the latest stats say over the last 20 years they've had a 5% higher return to shareholders. I think that sort of stuff, as that gets more press and there's more research done into this, is going to start demanding changes in behaviour at executive and board level. And the shareholders may actually start demanding it. So having women like this who are out here promoting these ideas and having further research happening in these areas, I think is going to just encourage this behaviour to continue, which I think is a good thing for everyone. So are there any further questions? We've probably got time for one or two more. Yep. We'll do two.
Andrew Gower, one of the points you were raising was around transparency. And would you see it as a success to move the current approach of, which seems to be often, especially 20 years ago, behind closed doors in generally the male-dominated clubs, to a system where there is an open and transparent approach? Is that going to be a good enough goal in itself, or do we need more?
Okay, transparency. When directorships appointments are transparent, women have got more chance of being considered. And so transparency is important to if you're looking to increase the numbers of women on boards. Whether it will be sufficient or not, I'm not sure. But in the short term, adopting a transparent approach will get more likely that a woman will get onto a board. And in fact, I'm just doing an exercise at the moment, and I won't mention for whom, but that was advertised quite publicly in a whole range of places. And as far as I can see, having waded through the 90 applicants, the women, on balance, are better qualified than the male applicants.
Okay, I am conscious that the final bell's just gone. Do you still want to come, if we go quick?
Come on. Hi, Paul Lewis. I'm from South Africa, and as a male, I'm here because transformation is obviously important to us, not only from a gender point of view, but from a race point of view. But the one comment I'd make on quotas is that there's a lot of talk in our sports teams about quotas. And on the cricket teams, for example, they did introduce quotas, and what happened is people, so non-white people who maybe wouldn't have got chosen, did get chosen, and ended up performing way beyond what was expected. In the end, they became merit people. But I think maybe if you don't have quotas, you don't have people who get picked, and therefore you don't inspire future generations. So that's maybe one reason why I think sometimes you end up having to have quotas in order to show some people that you can have females on boards and inspire the whole generation of future people. That was my comment.
Great. Thank you for that comment. We'll be repeating it in many places, I'm sure. One thing that Bronwyn and I were going to set up today and unfortunately fell through the cracks slightly was some tables at the lunch today, for which we're going to be set aside for people who want to discuss this. I'd just really like to encourage people to maybe get together and discuss some of the issues that we've talked about today. Ruth and Jenny will both be around, and Bronwyn and I will be around, so maybe we can have a further discussion after this. Thank you.
Okay. If you'd like to join me in thanking the speakers, I found it a really useful and informative session. Hope you have too. Thanks.
Thank you,
Ruth. No, I thought it was really...
Oh, thank you.
Oh, and could you please hand your forms in on the way out?
Don't worry, John won't let me get out the door.
Thanks for handing your forms in on the way out. Sorry about that.
Sorry, you're short. No, it didn't matter. It's not just this time. When you've had swings,
that's very easy cheering.
Thank you. Yeah. Do you do that later?
I certainly do. It's very easy. Well, let me just write it down on this piece of paper.
But, no, and some of it's about...
Just on Jenny with an eye. The fact that you had Jenny Japan. My home is actually in a place called Wilma, which is about 2 hours north of me. But I live in Tokyo.
Thank you very much.
There you go. Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Well, it was better than that. Asked fraud, you see what I mean? You know what I mean. That sounds I appreciate you coming, thank you.
That was very interesting. I'm now an expert on women on built and built from Europe. There's so much material. There is. No, I woke up this morning. So I'll send you what I found. It's gone down 24% to 39% Portugal, the worst. Portugal in 2008 had less than 1% female. Okay. Well, they are. So lots of potential. So there's been a big report in the UK that they're recommending 25% female. No, it's good to see you. I found out what the stuff is. Look, try to be calm.
Right. Really, an international degree. I think, in my mind, the most important thing is being confident in yourself. And if you feel the need to speak out, speak out. Clearly, the way you try to get your message across has a big impact. So, you've got this opportunity to go to some presentation workshops like that, but also very much watching other people. And how they can
I've decided I'm going to go and
thinking to yourself, okay, that works, but that's and that doesn't work.
Thank you. Yeah, I've always got to speak to you. You've got to see that. Yes.
Right.
Well, Dan,
When I started work, when I first got a management role, obviously I'm a female who at that time had a management role, and everywhere through my career, much as it seems to be strange, I've been the only woman, So it has been about watching how the guys do it.
Well, we used the other day.
And you know, some of them are very bad at it, but learning from both women and men, just irrespective of gender, who's getting their message across and who isn't. But one of the biggest issues I have seen with women is actually lack of confidence in themselves. And if you're not confident in yourself, you're not going to be confident in getting the message across. So it's very much being true to yourself and going, okay, I believe in myself, therefore I can portray that to others.
Well,
that's and get them to respect and believe in
them. That's right.
Yeah.
We're
going to
go. Thank you.
Yeah, I've got to leave it too because I forget my well, the problem is I miss
Thank you.
Thank you.